First of all, thank you very much for this very inspiring, thoughtful contributions by the three of you. Originally, we thought to have a longer discussion amongst the three of us, but I feel also sitting in the first row, there is a desire of the audience to discuss with our guests tonight. I just want to open the questions, and then we are giving directly to the audience that you have the possibility to share your opinions, your perspectives on the talks, which are really, from my perspective, a deep reflection on our contemporary situation we are in. And what I heard out of the three talks was that Taye Selassie describing or narrating this kind of micro scene at the airport, which was a scene basically about people who are in a paranoid situation, that you too try to contextualize in society what are the structures, what are the methods to create this kind of paranoia, which is narrated in your story. Perhaps a first question, and then it's all up to you, is, nevertheless, there is this one interesting, or two sentences, where we are more afraid of the unknown, the not seen man, than of the man from whom we know that he steals. The man who wants is more frightening than the man who steals, who takes it. What kind of structure of society is that?
Well, thank you, audience, for your patience. First of all, you've been troopers. To your question, Bernd, you said we are more afraid of the unknown, the man that we can't see. We can see him. His face isn't covered, his head may be, but we just don't look. And you speak about why are we more afraid of he who needs or he who wants than of he who takes? I think this is to what both my esteemed colleagues have suggested. This is to do with a long history of a coding of a kind of racial violence that allows for the toleration of one, that allows for the toleration of bombing and not of decapitation. I mean, you bring to mind something that I read a little while ago, and I think I've shared it with an audience in Germany, but it hasn't left me. And I was on a plane, as I'm always on a plane, and I was reading a sort of mediocre in-flight magazine, and in it was a list of the most peaceful countries in the world. And the description, there was a sort of two-sentence description of each, and the second most peaceful country in the world by some esteemed body had that year been named Sweden. And I think the first was Norway. And in lauding the peacefulness of Sweden, this is to your question about why we fear those who need and not those who take. In lauding the peacefulness of Sweden, the author in the In-Flight magazine had written, without apparent irony, as far as I could tell, jet-lagged though I was, that Sweden is so peaceful because there's no violence within its borders and this and this. And then in this throwaway line, it said, Sweden is also the number three exporter of arms in the world. And no, you laugh, I did too, but then I thought, this is the world we live in, a world where we will name the most peaceful country in the world, the country that exports arms to other nations, which we will call violent. That's the world in which we live.
The fear of the unknown is deeply driven by the refusal to have knowledge of those whom you fear. Right? So there's a deep drive to remain ignorant about in order to remove and exclude. And of course, those have deeply historical conditions underneath them that transform over time, so that the reference implicit in some of the images to ongoing crusades, of course, go back a very long way, right, to medievalism, late medievalism, in their imaginary. And that has to do also with the transformation in state making in the last 50 or 60 years from the liberal caretaking state, which was largely, not exclusively, but largely homogeneous, to the neoliberalizing state, which was the recourse to the individualization of self-responsibility in the name of getting rid of the caretaking state, not, however, getting rid of the state, to hyper-realize a state form that shifted resources from caretaking to surveillance, oversight, war-making, and the like. So you can actually see this in the size of budgets. And now more recently, as I was hinting at, from the neoliberalizing state to what I'm suggesting is the algorithmic and biometric state, which, if it were completely realized, would forgo the necessity of passports, of travel papers. Your signature would be inscribed in your thumb and your eye. And you would carry it around with you anywhere and everywhere. And in a way, states would morph into each other because it'd be this completely, I mean, in the absolutized sense, a seamless condition of knowing who you are and where you are at any point in time. That would, you know, forgo the need even to carry around and turn off your phone or leave your phone at home, your iPhone, when you were traveling, because they would have it inscribed in your very being itself.
Just maybe two quick comments. David mentions the double bind of knowledge on the one hand and ignorance on the other. I think the paradox of our times is that we, the possibility to know as many things as we can, many cultures as we can, that possibility has never been so manifest. We can know today almost anything we want to know. And yet, the cultivation of ignorance is part of the cultural temperament of our times. Not necessarily by all. I mean, some of us cannot really entertain the luxury of ignorance. Ignorance is the privilege of the powerful. And in the politics, geopolitics of our world, that is a key dimension. But I also think that there is a deep transformation of what stands as knowledge, which we really have to pay attention to. Yesterday, the purpose of knowledge was to explain as much as we could and to understand. It seems to me that more and more explanation and understanding has been replaced by listing, by data collection, risk profiling, algorithmic modeling, information integration, data analytics, and for the purpose of buying or selling. And that the restriction of what passes as knowledge is contraction to this procedural operation of listing and classifying and coding has led to the, and paradoxically to the expansion of the paranoid mentality.
Okay, so we open up to the floor. There's a question here. Where are the mic? Oh, sorry, here. The question here.
Hallo?
Ja, yes.
Danke. Ich werde meine Frage auf Deutsch stellen.
Oh, okay. I try to translate then. Okay.
Ja, mein Englisch liegt so fern vor, dass ich nicht ordentlich in Englisch sprechen kann. Gut.
No problem.
Ich möchte meine Frage, vor meiner Frage zwei Bemerkungen machen. Die eine Bemerkung ist, oder ja, diese Aussage, wonach die Leute nicht auf guten Daten eine falsche Überlegung machen, sondern als auf Basis von falschen Daten eine gute Überlegung machen, ist für mich sehr wichtig. Damit meine ich, die Leute, die hier zum Beispiel in Deutschland auf Spendeboxen schwarze Kinder sehen, die in Reihe stehen, um auf Essen zu warten, können nicht ein anderes Gedanken haben, als gegenüber Schwarzen Rassist zu werden. Das ist sehr wichtig. Das heißt, die Grundlage, worauf die sogenannten Radikalen oder die Rassisten, ich rede von der Bevölkerung, von der tieferen Bevölkerung, worauf die Basis ist, ja, da geliefert. Und die zweite Bemerkung ist, wenn die Leute in Talkshows sagen, das Problem Afrikas besteht darin, dass die Grenzen willkürlich gezogen wurden. Das stimmt, aber sie sagen das, weil sie aus Basis von diesem Erkenntnis oder von dieser Tatsache neue imperialistische Politik machen wollen, die darauf basiert, dass diese willkürliche Grenze neu geschaffen werden oder neu konstruiert werden. Darauf meine Frage, wie weit sind die interessanten Aufträge bewusst, dass diese Musik von Antirassismus oder von, wie nennt man das, Weltbürgertum und all diese Sachen, wie weit sind Sie bewusst, dass diese Musik schon von dem Herrschenden und von dem Imperialisten schon längst gespielt und getrieben werden? Das ist meine Frage.
Wow.
Danke.
The second point I think I got. second point was that the people who are hinting at that the borderlines in Africa are artificial, they have themselves power interests. And the question is, to what extent people such as us are realizing that? Or
Kennen die Vorträge?
Or if you are conscious of that, that this is a game of interests, so to say. I think this, let's take this second question, because first I did not really get right. You understand? The hinting at the fact that the borderlines in Africa were artificially made is used as an argument of people to play power games. So it's a functionalized argument. Yeah, I think we take a few remarks. So there's another one over there.
Yeah, thank you so much. I would like to, was it for you? Okay,
You start.
I will
start. We take then
okay.
Another one.
I would like to pick up the question of the borders of violence, and I would like to ask. We had a lot of discussions before that concerning the questions about microaggressions, safe places. So we talked about the object of violence today, and not so much about the act itself or the extensions of the act. That at the moment, violence is extended a lot, addressing little things, microaggressions, or in the essay, for example, staring without looking at something is also addressed as a violence. And my question is this, if I say provocatively, a bit watering of this concept, is it a danger that it might lead to, or similar to the problem that post-raciality is, that we cannot grasp real hard, like violence. I would like you're shaking your head, but I think that would be an interesting question I would like to hear.
Are these micro situations violent situations, Ben?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have the mic.
Check.
The man with the mic.
Hi.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
Sorry.
Yeah, please. No, sorry. The man behind you.
Okay, thanks. David, addressed to you, but I guess anybody could take it. Thanks for your trenchant diagnosis of this post-racial catastrophe. I wonder, however, if, and please bear with the metaphor, this virus of whiteness, not to externalize whiteness from white bodies, is only now experiencing some kind of outbreak. Isn't it actually the losers of racial capitalism, right? These like working class white folks, very often mentioned or in your photos, who are expressing this very like rabid version of whiteness, right? In this, where whiteness is not singular in its oppressive qualities, but it is in power and losing it, obviously. If you think of whiteness as property and so on. But isn't it then the beneficiaries, the diversity lovers, the refugee helpers, the center, left, right, neoliberal consensus, who are the more dangerous symptom of this outbreak? And what would you say then to how we can diagnose the problem, if you agree, in part with this analysis? Just to add on to that, I would ask Taye and Achille, what you would make if you think of Gaza as the metaphor for the future, what you would make of this dubious attitude of the German left, which responds to the question of Israel in this very ambiguous, dubious manner, where a part of it is pro-Israel, pro the state of Israel and the settlements and the oppression and so on, where the Jewish question, you could say, comes back to haunt the German left, this time as farce, as the Israel question. What do you make, what do you have to say to that?
Okay. Sorry, could we just have a question from a woman?
Okay. We take. No, here is also a woman. I mean, there are.
I have the mic, thanks.
Okay, over there.
Just
go ahead.
Thank you. Achille was talking about the watch and kill list and the new qualities of violence that are emerging, I wanted perhaps to think also about who then is the enemy of the state, because if that seems an important question here, it could be the blogger who is blogging from America and is killed when he lands into Dhaka. It could be the first Muslim woman judge in the Hudson River. I think this is something perhaps to also consider when we're talking about the watch and kill lists today. Who is that enemy?
Okay, we make a first round here and then we start with you in the second round. It's working.
Okay, so there have been a couple of stated points about violence and on the one hand, when one talks about microaggressions as violence, one can't dismiss them because they're not unrelated to the creation and extension of attitudinal relationships that then underpin the kind of condoning of what you seem to be gesturing as real violence, right? Violence by the state, violence by of killing people, and so on and so forth. That's not to say that all forms of denial of safe space and so on are equal to bombs dropping on people or shots being taken at people and so on and so forth. But they're also not unrelated, and the creation of dispositions that are also produced in the culture, whether by video games, whether by the kind of you know, letting go of a kind of critical take in relation to what counts as violence. Well, video games aren't violent. They might have violence in them, but they're not producing violence because they're not affecting people and so on and so forth, seems to give up the relational qualities between the production of a culture in which people live, operate, understand things, give up a kind of critical disposition towards, that then translate into saying, oh, you know, where drones from 10,000 miles away and 5,000 feet sort of down become a, you know, tantamount to being experienced as video game-like. And so it's no different than the video game I'm playing in the privacy of my living room. So I think one needs to think about, you know, the deep relationality between these sets of conditions. You know, when we, you know, likewise, there are relational conditions between, and it's not just the white working class who are expressing these forms of violence. I mean, I had quotes there from Bill O'Reilly. He's hardly a working class guy, right? And so I think it's pervasive across a whole range of class formations. It's partly why I ended with the reach for a coalitional politics, cross-class, cross-gender, cross-racial, that come together around different sets of commitments in relation to the racial and the violent, and then might come undone and reconstitute itself around a different set of commitments over time. One should not think, I mean, the civil rights movement effected something and then dissipated into, you know, what you might call as a, or, you know, anti-apartheid or anti-colonialism and so on, not all of which were liberal, but gave way to a set of conditions. You know, anti-racism is a not one-time condition. It's not something that happens all at once. It's not eventful in that kind of way. It requires ongoing commitment across lifetimes in order both to attend to and to undo the bits and pieces that speak also to aid workers and you know, those liberal forms of giving. I'll just add one point about, you know, not reproducing the very condition that then enables aid working to be the only undertaking that we have in relation to the world that is in need, right? The point is to produce, enable a set of conditions that enables itself to transform itself without imposition on what it or they want to be.
I think I will just make a brief comment on the Africa-related question. Africa is really interesting in this debate, which will be, as I was suggesting, an important debate of the first half of the 21st century, because it gives us an archive of questions of bordering that is quite different from what we are witnessing right now. It's not as if in pre-colonial Africa there were no borders, but the function of borders was literally to be transgressed. The border, people invented borders as a mechanism to facilitate their crossing. It was never a mechanism to close for enclosure. The other interesting thing was that in the absence of classical nation-state forms, modalities of belonging were always multiple. You didn't belong simply because you were a citizen. There was a whole range of modes of belonging that were available for those who wanted to be citizens, those who only were visitors, those who, although visiting, wanted to settle but not really become citizens. So the question is, if we really want to expand the frontiers of democracy in this age of planetary entanglement, we can only do that if we diversify modes of belonging beyond national citizenship. As far as Africa is concerned, we do then have a deep, rich archive for debates on how is it that we share the world. Because the question of borders, that is what it's all about. That our world is becoming smaller and smaller, is not expanding. It's not as if tomorrow morning we'll just leave and go and settle in another planet. This is the only world we have, at least for the time being. If it belongs to us all, humans and non-humans, the condition of its sustainability is indeed to share it. Because if we cannot share it, nothing can guarantee that it will last forever, or that we will last forever. So when we raise questions of borders, bordering, that's the problematic we are trying to put on the table. As far as the continent is concerned, it's doubly penalized. It is penalized in the sense that there's not one single country in the world today where African people are welcomed. I mean, there are degrees of inhospitality, and black people in particular, and African people, are at the bottom of those who, to whom hospitality is extended. They are not welcomed. But nor are they welcomed in their own continent, because we have 53 or 54 states, each of which has at least three or four national boundaries with other states. So this double penalization make it such that this colossal continent, because to go to Casablanca, to Cape Town, non-stop, you spend the entire day in the plane. So this colossal continent is being turned into a carceral space. So things are very clear. Of course, I understand that there are interests in maintaining colonial borders the way they are. But for the continent to become a center and a force proper, it will have to open itself up to itself and be turned into a vast space of circulation. That is one way in which it seems to me we can begin to excavate the political, cultural consequences of debates on borders.
And then I would just address the young woman's question here about how do we define an enemy of the state. To David's critical distinction, I think one would first have to define the function of the state. So if the function of the state, if we accept it to be caretaking, then an enemy of the state would be anything or anyone that threatens the welfare of the citizens of the state. But of course, once we've moved to a function of the state that is either surveillance or control or exclusion, then the enemy of the state is anything that threatens that. And this, I think, is the true tragedy of our time. That I'm so sorry if there are Swedish people here, I'm sure you're nice. But I think a lot about good old, peaceful, arms-dealing Sweden, because if the function of a state like that is to generate wealth to then distribute amongst a small proportion of its citizens while excluding other possible citizens, then an enemy of the state is anything that threatens that trade. But if it is indeed the welfare of people, anyone who might be called citizen, anyone who might be called human that falls within the borders, then we would define it in a completely different way.
So we have a second round of questions, 3 to 4. Please be sharp and precise.
Yes, I have a question about spaces, the spaces we occupy. We talked a lot about state violence and nationalism and police brutality, but I want to know about the spaces that we occupy on a daily basis, our workspaces, our home spaces, academic institutions, art and cultural institutions, the club. We often forget about the racialized violence in these spaces. So take this space, for instance. Example would be the entrance fee to come in. The fact that this space tonight is majority white. And often I hear directors and programmers and artistic directors saying that they couldn't find black and people of color. And so my question to you, since two of you work in academic institutions and you all work in art and cultural institutions, how can we disrupt these spaces? How do we disrupt this racialized violence in these spaces? And how do we center blackness? Okay.
Another question?
Another microphone?
Here. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question for Ashin Bembe. When you write about necropower, necropolitics, I'm here. I, of course, I think of the drone, or I think of the decapitation, I think of the refugee droning in the Mediterranean Sea, but more logically to me comes the idea of social death, of the illegal migrant in Europe that has, for example, no right to health assistance or to any kind of support or to of life. Can you comment on that? Can you tell me how you link, or if you link, this idea of necropower and necropolitics to social death? And not only in slavery, of course.
Okay. Yeah, please. Here, and then the last one over there.
You talked about the ideal of democracy as a thing, how to overcome violence possibly all over the world, or in that case, you mentioned it in relation to Africa. I would like to put the question in the direction of the concept of democracy you are thinking about. For my understanding, democracy has very different types of realization. And when the most of the people, and I think in the matter of how it was used over here, we are thinking about democracy which is related to our kind of Western type of living. It's a style of living which is related to a claim to realize it in a globalized world. And in that dreaming, there is the, how's it called, the dreaming of throwing down borders by having all over the world the same status of life, and that is something which is not possible. And I would like that you take a position to this question in relation of your exposures.
A last question over there. Whoever has the mic.
So I would like to mention two names, I mean two words rather, junta and warlord. In the 60s, Germany was actually flooded with Greek people who ran away from the junta in Greece. And they actually gave us, you see, I mean, Greek restaurants. How can we link up, you see, I mean, concepts like junta and warlordism with the violence that we have heard about?
Okay, I think we stop now and take this.
Go ahead. Do you want to start?
You want to start?
Sure. I just, Jessica, will you repeat the end of your question?
How can we disrupt?
How can we disrupt spaces, academic institutions, and art and cultural institutions? How can we center blackness and give space for blackness in those institutions?
Okay, I'm actually going to let you take that. No, because, as you know, I'm far from...
Talk about passing the buck. I think if one thinks about the academy, the university, in historical terms, at least in the development of modernity, sort of in post-Enlightenment modernity, increasingly, well, for the first part, the university was to educate, and the knowledge that was provided was to form sort of elite class formations and to reproduce itself in somewhat those terms. From the middle to late 19th century onwards, and particularly into the 20th century, that transformed, I mean, as universities proliferated, as new universities were built, as more and more people came into the university in the United States and Britain and elsewhere, I mean, the English-speaking world that I know best, there was a dramatic increase in the university population after the Second World War, particularly in the late 1950s onwards, new universities were built and so on. And so the university transformed into the cultivation of a middle class. And all of that, of course, was a reproduction of whiteness, and was a reproduction of whiteness in its knowledge formation, not just in the color of the bodies that that entered its hallways, right? And it was quite self-conscious in its self-reproduction, not unlinked to the development of the caretaking state, which was largely homogeneous, or seen to be largely homogeneous, and so on. So when one thinks, and so it's terrifically unfriendly to anybody who is seen not to embody, in every sense of the term, embody, that set of recognitions, right? And so black folk in particular find the academy a hostile environment, quite literally. And in many ways it is. I mean, both in the disposition towards them on the part of faculty. I mean, there's lots of data, you know, in the US, for example, that faculty will more readily answer white men students than they will women or people of color, right? Right, when they get email requests, when they get people knocking on their door, the availability to them, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, it's a deeply hostile environment. So the question then becomes how one transforms the very culture of the environment itself. And the first thing to think about, you know, in Europe, I mean, I think this is a pressing question as well. Here I know the Netherlands better than the German case, but it's hostile to the presence of black people too. The question is how one transforms the place of the academy, both spatially, right, more open, but link that to the transformation of the knowledge formation that is being produced and reproduced. So South Africa is now in, and it's being reproduced elsewhere, is in the mode of contesting the colonization of knowledge. And of course, there's a deep sense to the formation that precludes, that closes down, that Achille has written about in the Critique of Black Reason, the way in which black folk are not taken to have reason. Right, at least through the colonial period and its traces into the contemporary. So the question then becomes to recognize the value, the alter value, you might say, the value of otherwiseness, right? That people with a different set of experiences, both as students and as faculty and indeed as administrators, bring into the transformation of that very condition to open it up to not just to make it less hostile, but to make it hospitable, to make it as much embodied by the heterogeneity of the society as other institutions of importance.
See, I passed the microphone because I didn't want to deny you the richness of this answer, but I would add in a much more pedestrian sense, another way to do that is to make access less expensive. One of the slides that resonated so powerfully in David's presentation was the one saying, who is our enemy, who is our enemy? It's poverty, but the reality of the matter is, and we must acknowledge, that race is in every way a socioeconomic construct, and one of the barriers to brown bodies in these white spaces is money. And you alluded to it in passing, an entrance fee, or in the United States, college tuition and associated college debt, all of these seemingly race-neutral economic barriers must be addressed for, I think, the strategies of exclusion intended or otherwise that they are.
Can I just very quickly add, I recently ran a workshop for graduate students across the University of California, and there was a panel on student debt, a very important point. Students of all racial backgrounds who were speaking on this panel were expressing that a graduate student in the humanities is carrying $100,000 of debt out of college, right? It's time for free public higher education worldwide.
The issue of democracy. Yes.
The question of democracy and then of social debt. Of course, there are many different ways in which a critique of liberal democracy, because that is what I had in mind, has been made and can be made at this specific moment of our lives. It can be made from the perspective of different kinds of archives. I'm sure that a Chinese archive would give us resources to critique democracy that an Indian archive doesn't. But if I were to make a critique of liberal democracy from the point of view of what I call an African library, then I would be in a position to say two or three things. I'll summarize them briefly. One is that the idea of democracy is not entirely Western. Nor is it, you know what I mean, so I won't elaborate on that. The idea of democracy refers to a project, a community of life. A community of life not only among humans, but a community of life that is transgenerational, that is premised on some concept or the other of a debt, that we owe each other something. We then debate on what is it that we owe each other and how is it that we settle it in such a way as to not pile up debts for those who come after us, kind of expropriatory debt, but a debt that allows us to make sure that the human is not turned into waste. And the challenge of liberal democracy in this age of hyper-financialization of the economy, age of hyper-abstraction, is precisely to put together the mechanisms that prevent the human from being turned into waste. I think that is probably at the roots of it, the most radical critique we can make. As far as the question of social death is concerned, I mean, necropolitics was a moment, sure, still with us, and this has changed. But what strikes me, I mean, I travel a lot in the continent, in major cities, Dakar, Abidjan, Lagos, What strikes me the most is the amount of labor of care people put in repairing that which has been broken. Objects, social relations. So this question of reparation or repair, if you want, I think we haven't really critically reflected about it. And if this is indeed a major aspect of how people organize their lives, they live their lives on an everyday basis in that part of the world, then it seems to me that the reflection on social death has to be complemented by this reflection on the politics of repair and the politics of care. Because the two go together. And this has tremendous impacts on how we think of technologies, for instance. The vernacular technologies of repair that are put in motion in those contexts in which so many forces are arraigned, especially against the urban poor. The little he or she has is constantly taken away from him or her. Then it seems to me that it's an avenue we can explore in reimagining what it would mean to share the world in this age of planetary entanglement. That has nothing to do with, opening completely your borders to deal with the misery of the world. But it has to do with whether or not we owe each other something. And what is it? Or is it that we really don't owe each other anything? I think that is the question we have to answer collectively. It can't be answered nationally any longer.
I have, since I also feel myself responsible to answer this question of the role of cultural institution and the money as a gatekeeper, I think to put that also in a wider context, what we did with our society is that the medium in which we discuss relationships, the medium in which we evaluate human relationships, social processes, is the medium of money. So what is happening in our societies is a kind of abstraction, a kind of objectivization of social human processes by evaluating them with money and with numbers, basically. So I think this is at the heart of a process which is not only reflecting racist borderlines, but it's also a self-colonization of our societies. So at the heart of the processes which seems to exclude others, I think, are processes which at the same time are colonizing ourselves. And I leave you with this for the moment, but I think, of course, we all have to fight to put these thresholds lower and lower. I can assure you that we will offer, and we are doing, offer at the moment already, quite a number of programs without any payment. But this is not good enough. I completely agree to that. But to come to the conclusion of the day, you all know that's part of secret knowledge. You should not answer all the questions. So I leave you with that, and you have a question. You are not supposed to.
I just wanted one person in the audience to tell me the answer to my first question.
Okay.
One person, which was, when you listen to the description of a man with a covered head, who did you see?
Trayvon Martin.
Thank you.
Can you say the microphone for outside people sitting outside?
I think of Trayvon Martin immediately.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to say that my generation has really screwed up things for generations to come. We've screwed it up in every sense of the word and around the world. And in that sense, if you look at contemporary data, a study was recently done in the US, something like 60% of millennials no longer have faith in democracy. They are quite happy not to ever vote for anybody, to have an authoritarian leader, I guess like Trump, who's more, you know, entertaining than the Dow bureaucrat, not involved in secret administrological sort of undertaking and so on. So the question I think that I want to pose for everybody is, how do we transform those conditions to give generations to come much more hope than they currently have?
So thank you very much, and good night.